Like I was one of the blessed one. Yeah, I was born in Norway, so privileged. Although, you know, I had a very kind of traumatic childhood, I had a lot of resources. And then I found spirituality. I did all the practice. I was in India every year. And if I can't live in peace in my relationship, how can I expect there to be peace in the world? And I suddenly saw I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that led me into a kind of a brutal honesty where I saw that that's not okay for me. I just really saw that split between my inner realization. I know the vast love of the divine. And in that and in that process of being seeing myself in the mirror and becoming very honest with myself, in the pain of really feeling the pain of that schism, that split, there was a commitment rising in me where I was really seeing that if I shall spend the rest of my life failing or not knowing how, nevertheless, I will spend my life finding a way to embody the big love that I know in my heart, to live it for real.
Welcome to Collecting Sparks. I am Sarah Schill, and I'm meeting with people who send out sparks with what they do or who they are. Collecting those sparks is my deep passion, and I hope our conversations will send out sparks to you too so that they can continue to fly. Today's guest is Charmeli Adak. Charmeli is the founder of the Wisdom School Awakening Women, mysticist, yogini, amazing storyteller, and for me, one of the great spiritual teachers of today. In her teachings, she uses mythology and ancient wisdom as a key to spiritual awakening. Her own path has led her to an embodied, earth-rooted spirituality. And today she teaches women's circles all around the world. Working with her both on and offline has changed my whole view of spirituality. The realization that our body might not be an obstacle to overcome, but in fact the portal that leads us to the present moment and through that connects us to the divine has been an eye-opener. Instead of spiritual bypassing, Charmeli's teachings welcome all of us, the shadows, the hidden parts, the pain and grief, as well as joy, desire or laughter. There's no need to flee or neglect. It's all part of the divine. Isn't that amazing? You will hear that we recorded this interview some months ago when spring was just rising. For different reasons, it took me a while to release this episode, but as summer is now drawing back and we get ready for a new cycle, I find it astonishingly perfect. We also speak about Charmeli's realization that the wars on the outside were a mirror for the destructive patterns in herself, an issue that sadly is more than relevant in these times. The healing of the wound of separation became Charmeli's North Star. She from there on followed. She describes how this decision opened 1,000 doors for her and led her to a new way of understanding the world and herself. Charmeli shares her approach for decoding ancient mythological keys and how changing the perspective on a story might shift the truth. Her immense wisdom and knowledge continue to blow my mind. Some of the quotes she shares here are so dear to my heart that I really hope you listen with attention and openness. I will link all ways to work with Charmeli and Awakening Women, as well as other projects in the show notes. But for now, let's open this conversation with Charmeli Adak. Has spring yet arrived, or tell me a bit about the land where you're at the moment?
So I'm in the Northern California in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains. And so we have this very kind of indecisive springtime coming. So sometimes it's very warm and sometimes it is snowing all of a sudden. So we are in the midst of that kind of shift between winter and spring. So it goes back and forth here.
And what does spring, or what does the change of nature and the cycles, what does it mean to you? How does it influence you in your practice, but also in your being in the world? Can you say
that? Yeah, just like this shift between the seasons right now, it is so easy for me to recognize it inside myself too. Just that sense of the spark of new energy coming, the kind of the kind of rumbling within the seeds. But at the same time, the winter is not over yet. So it is, you know, it is asking me to hold two energies or this kind of spectrum of energies within me at the same time. So I notice myself wanting to hold on to the hibernation and the inward movement of the winter, which I cherish a lot. And then at the same time, we have this, the impulses are coming, but it's not yet time. So this phase is particularly hard for us to hold, because it is to hold different energies without necessarily acting or creating right away. It's to hold the becoming, the kind of the waiting, the gestation, and holding the possibility of spring, but not forcing it or pushing it.
Does that come easy to you, the holding and also the understanding?
No, not at all. No, it is, of course, at the center of the embodiment practices that I have been involved in for many, many decades, to cultivate the capacity to hold energies and feelings in the body, in the container of awareness. Awareness becomes the space. Awareness becomes the container that allows us to feel and think without being the thought or being the feeling. Yeah, that there's a certain kind of room around it that allows us also to have more choice with the different feelings and thoughts that are appearing. So, yes, I have practiced that, but it's not easy. It's not easy to hold that, the shift of seasons. It's never been for my body. But my body is nature. So you can see all around that it is challenging, when you can feel into that, what happens within the seed, that impulse is coming. And it is to leave the familiar, is to leave that which has been its home for a long time. And then to follow a desire, to follow an impulse, to become something it doesn't even know. It just follows its own nature. And then it has to kind of break free from the seed, and it has to embark on this journey up through the dark soil. It's just a tremendous courage that is needed. And it is a tremendous creative power that is happening and that is guiding this sprout to move into the unknown, because it wants the light, it wants the sun. So that is an intense process, and that is our own bodies, and are made of the same thing. It is the very same thing. So I would say that although that is a process that is constantly, moving in me and working in me, I guess what is easier after practice is that there's less ideas that is something wrong with this process. It's less ideas that it should be different. And that is, how we human add this extra layer of suffering.
Yeah, for me, it was really when I first heard about this thought that it could be okay to not search, for spirituality or for connection on the outside or overcome this incarnation, but to really land here and to connect to source, to the divine through the body. And and as you're saying, also to the cycles of nature, to truly listen to what is here right now and what is questioned of us. Because I can feel it also, this wanting to sprout and wanting to do so many things, and at the same time still this this holding back and saying, like, have a little more patience, When was the first time that you felt this embodiment that we can connect to our spirituality through the body and to fully open and incarnate fully?
For me, I was from a very early age, like my late teenage years, I started, to explore spirituality and meditation and the paths that were available to me. I went to India early, and I learned all these incredible meditations and ways that I could access a dimension of myself that were, more peaceful, more intelligent, more wise than my personal thoughts and feelings and dramas and pain that I was in. But what I also experienced was that there was this kind of split between the experiences I had in my practice and the way I actually lived my life. Like, it was this painful schism between the love that I realized in my heart and the way that I spoke to my partner at the time, for example, or the way we were dealing with conflicts and communication and the way love expressed itself through my body. seemed to be very different than the realization in my heart. The patterns that I saw in my relationships were really very similar to the patterns I saw in my parents' relationship and the relationships around me. So that led me to this kind of sense of, when I closed my eyes, I felt peace. When I opened my eyes, I felt drama. So it was this kind of, oh, I got it. Oh, in the retreat in India, oh, I got it. And then once my partner started to speak, I lost it. Yes, I said, I got it. I lost it. I got it. Mm-hmm. I lost it. Now I have to find it again. So it was this kind of sense of being on a hamster wheel that just kept me back into the same loops of seeking, of trying to get there, to trying to hold on to a certain state or experience that I called the divine or spiritual. And then it was actually when the terrorist attack on Manhattan and 9/11, you know, 11th mm-hmm. September, that was like, I was in Norway at the time. And I remember I watched it on TV. I was working as a therapist. And I remember something happened, you know, in the whole world, of course, it was a tremendous shock and kind of a, it was a few days thereafter where everything was so electric and so open and so kind of everybody was so unmasked and there was something that was possible in that window. And of course, it closed again into fear and revenge and all of these things. Yeah. But for me personally, it was a sense of being faced with a mirror where I saw, you know, I saw this destruction, this hate, so visible, and so, you know, the consequences of that mindset so visible. It was like looking into a mirror, and I started to recognize that the pattern, although it didn't have that harmful consequences in my relationship, I saw it's the same patterns.
And really?
I saw that the conflict, the way that I was, like, I was one of the blessed one, yeah? I was born in Norway, so privileged. Although, you know, I had a very kind of traumatic childhood, I had a lot of resources. And then I found spirituality. I did all the practice. I was in India every year. And if I can't live in peace in my relationship, how can I expect there to be peace in the world? And I suddenly saw I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that led me into a kind of a brutal honesty where I saw that that's not okay for me. I just really saw that split between my inner realization. I know the vast love of the divine. And in that process of seeing myself in the mirror and becoming very honest with myself, in the pain of really feeling the pain of that schism, that split, there was a commitment rising in me where I was really seeing that if I shall spend the rest of my life failing or not knowing how, nevertheless, I will spend my life finding a way to embody the big love that I know in my heart, to live it for real. And I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to do it in relationships. But if I'm going to fail for the rest of my life doing that, this is what I want to fail in. This is what I want to dedicate my life to. And it was like a marriage. Like I married that mission.
In that very moment?
Or in the days after,
in the days. Uh-huh. Did you have help in this process? Or was it really something you explored for yourself?
Well, it was like you know, sometimes when crisis hits, because this has happened a few times in my life, things becomes very stripped down. Yeah, there is an opportunity there where you begin to see yourself beyond the different patterns that you identify with. So for me, it was a process I was in right there. And then I had a teacher. I remember I went to her later in India and really made a commitment to bridge my inner world and my outer world. And, you know, it meant the end of that relationship. It meant the end of so many things for me. Mm-hmm. But what happened was that in that moment, I didn't know how to do that. But I jumped off the fence. I jumped 2 feet in. And I said, this is what my life is going to be about. And the moment I jumped 2 feet in, 1,000 doors opened. And I believe that those doors, they didn't even exist until I made a commitment. Commitment is that same quality of that seed the sprout and the seed. It's that kind of when you commit to that, commit to what really matters, there is an energy in it that creates the world, that creates the springtime, that creates everything. It's that very same force that I tapped into in that moment. And since then, the doors have just kept on opening.
And it, yeah, these opening doors, was it revelations or people you met, or how did you find that path? Because it's
it was that willingness again, like we spoke about mm-hmm. in the beginning, the willingness to hold the not knowing, the hold the urge and the longing and the energy, but without it taking form yet. So, you know, one essential part I think we have to learn in our spiritual path and in our creative path is that the very fact that you don't know how to do it doesn't mean that you're on the wrong path. It just requires of us to stand in that. Just like the springtime now, it's not obvious. Like, it's not like it's, you know, the springtime is following certain patterns that recur every year. Yeah, so that the leaf that comes now in the spring is brand new. It's never been before in the universe. It's like unique, mm-hmm. that leaf. But it follows a pattern of leaf, yeah. And it's the same thing with us, that we have certain kind of blueprints. It's not like a fixed destiny, but we have certain patterns that we can recognize. Like, I work a lot with goddess mythology. In the mythology, we see these maps and these blueprints that we can use as a guidance for our very unique journey. So what happened to me in that moment was that I fell into the river of me. Like, I fell into what really matters to me. And in that, it's not like a static place or an insight. It's to fall into alignment with the evolution of me. And, you know, it took for me to strip down a lot of spiritual ideas that, for example, that spiritual liberation is found outside of the physical, for example, mm-hmm. you know, that create, yeah. inevitable will create that split. Because then it's like spirit, it's this duality. It's like this division that will, like the Buddhists call that the root suffering.
Yeah.
The root of all suffering is that misunderstanding that there is a division in the divine. And that makes us take so many actions that are not beneficial for us. So I prayed a lot. Mm-hmm. I prayed a lot. I was like, I don't know how to do this, but please guide me, please use me. Instead of trying to seek the next spiritual state, my practice became a practice of how can I embody the whatever love and freedom I have access in my practice, not trying to chase a higher state, but to find a way to embody it here and now through my body. So that was the beginning of a different kind of practice for me.
That you developed yourself in this phase.
So in the beginning, so this is a long time ago now. it eventually led me to the goddess path, for sure. Mm-hmm. And for me, meeting the goddesses was like, it was like walking into a hall of mirrors where I could recognize myself and parts of myself that in my spiritual practice I have been told were not holy. Like, of my feelings and things like that I should get rid of, I should get move beyond or transcend. In the meeting with the goddesses, I saw rage, I saw sexuality, I saw giggling, I saw all aspects mirrored back to me in the form of the divine, which was such a liberation and part of this kind of weaving. Like, my spirituality is all about integration, weaving all the parts that we think are not holy, all the parts that we exile into the shadow, weaving them back into consciousness, into wholeness, mm-hmm. which is the very nature of goddess.
Mm-hmm. And the goddess path, this is a lot also the mythology and the stories you're using that shows certain patterns or certain parts of ourselves?
Goddess mythology is, it's like maps of consciousness, not only human mm-hmm. consciousness. It really places us in a bigger picture that we are part of this big life-death cycle that is breathing us, feeding us, eating us. And the myths, they awaken memory in us, original instructions that are patterns in our DNA. The myths are not only the content of the myths, but it is the many, many different characters in the myth and also the patterns of the myth. You can follow patterns, the momentum of myths. Just like I said, that the springtime, it has a certain pattern that happens. Although the content of the spring is new, it's a certain mm-hmm. recurring pattern. And it's the same in myths. You can recognize patterns from all over the world. And so it's somehow, just like we see a pattern in the leaf, the pattern in the myth is just a human translation of these instructions and the way that we can relate to it. So I have been telling stories and practicing with stories with circles, you know, all over the world for many decades now. And it's just so incredible to see how women and people from all kinds of different backgrounds resonate with the myth. Like, you know, when you, even the fairy tales, they come from the same patterns, the same roots. And we recognize them. Yeah, there's something tickling in us where we begin to, oh, yes. And we see both possibilities and parts of consciousness. It also, I see a lot of practices in myth. So that's how I work with them. You know, that we practice. It's like different keys that the myths are offering to us that we can bring into our bodies.
And you have the feeling that because you're an incredible storyteller and collecting stories from all different kinds of traditions, but that there are roots and patterns that unite us, or that
absolutely
we can recognize?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like now I am, like most of my spiritual upbringing was in India. I've been here, you know, I've been in India more than 20 times. I went there, you know, first time more than 30 years ago. And so, you know, that is really where I had my spiritual upbringing, in a very kind of intimate and very long-term relationship to the goddesses and the mythology there. And now, just the last years, I've been studying and practicing with the Nordic mythology mm-hmm. and goddesses that are from my roots, yeah, from Norway, and also the Germanic roots. It's the mm-hmm. you know, just the same. And it is incredible to see the similarities from the Indian mythology to the Nordic mythology. It's just so many similar keys and maps that we can recognize in these different traditions. It's like a myth is like a hologram or mm-hmm. a jewel that you can approach from different angles and different perspectives. So the myths, they are in many ways illustrating also our historical events. They are illustrating shifts in society and cultures. But of course, history and society and politics and cultures are expressions of human consciousness. Yeah. So mm-hmm. we can also then bring a perspective into the human consciousness. And in the human consciousness, we can also bring it into the human body. And the human body is an expression of Earth. So it kind of leads us into this circle where Earth is the water and the food that the historical events were, you know, we're feeding the historical events, and it goes around like this. And so it weaves us into what I call kind of this Vird consciousness in the Nordic mythology. Vird is a name for the world web. It's like we see mm-hmm. that everything is just energetic interconnectivity that we are part of. So for example, an image from the Nordic mythology is the world tree. Were, you know, and at the root of the world tree, the roots are drinking from different wells. One well is the memory of the universe. We can drink from the memory. One is the Ur, the original instructions, and the different wells. And then up in the top, you have the eagle and also a falcon. And at the roots, there's a snake circling around the roots. And this image, when in our practice, we bring it into our body. So the tree becomes the spine, the roots becomes our connected, also our subconsciousness, and also deeper roots in the dark. And then the eagle eye consciousness is that vaster perspective. And the snake is the life force energy there. And we can bring it into the Indian mythology and yogic maps, where we see the Kundalini Shakti, you know, pictured like the snake. We see the Shiva consciousness, which is that eagle eye view. So we can see that it follows, these mythologies and maps are following. They are mirroring what aspects of consciousness and expression of consciousness in the form that is life, that is the world. So of course we can recognize it all over.
In this image, I see you like as a translator in a way. I was practicing with you last year in Hamburg together with my mom, which was very powerful to see, because many of us listen to a story and they just hear the surface, you know, the story.
Yes.
And I see you as this, you know, decoding those patterns and those keys and then sharing it with women all over the world.
Yes, and that is again as a, it's a skill. There's a certain way, you know, when you are, if you're looking at the kind of you know, those 3D photos that in the beginning when you look at them they just look like patterns, and then you just shift your the way you look, you squint your eyes a little bit, and then all of a sudden it starts to become an image that pops out. I don't know if you've seen that. But it's a little bit like that when I encounter stories. You know, early on in my studies, I was very involved in Buddhist studies. And with the Buddhism and also in so many traditions, what we encounter when we relate to stories is that a lot of the stories were, you know, they were orally transmitted for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So it's until recently where they began to be written down. And when they were written down, first of all, it was mostly men who could write, not everywhere, but mostly. And it was men living in a certain kind of culture and social context that has certain views on women and nature, for example. So when they then wrote down the stories, they will inevitably write it down in the way they understand it. So it will be very limited to a certain kind of consciousness that that person have. But it doesn't mean that the stories are lost. They just, you just have to read through the lines. You know, one trick is oftentimes to see, when you see in the stories, you see who the enemy is. And then you ask yourself, what would this story look like if it was told from the enemy's perspective? For example, there is, for example, a story from the Greek mythology of the oracle in Delphi, which was a, you know, very, very powerful goddess site. And it is said that the oracle in Delphi was Gaia's oracle. It was the navel of the earth. It's where earth could speak to us and transmit her wisdom. And she had priestesses and a whole kind of spiritual tradition around her right there in Delphi. And then the myth tells us how Apollo, which is this brilliant, beautiful sun god, he comes because they hear that around Delphi, there's this big serpent that is kind of guarding Delphi. But the story says that Apollo, he comes in like the hero and he kills the serpent and kind of saves the oracle from this snake and this destructive energy. And he now becomes the god of the oracle. So, and there's still priestesses there, but now it is his wisdom that is transmitted through the oracle. And so in the aftermath, most of us have heard that story, is that of course Apollo is the hero, and he is now, it is said that this was the beginning of the civilization, the civilized world, yeah, where he was like erasing this very primal energy of the serpent. When we meet the snake and the serpent in the myths, it's the primal life force energy, and it is one of the oldest goddess symbols we have. So if you look at it from another perspective, from Gaia's perspective, or from the snake's perspective, is Apollo the hero? What is it that we call civilized world? You know, that is like, what place has women in the civilized world, or the feminine or the goddess powers? Yeah, it was in one way, the civilized world was the conquering of the goddess, and it, you know, into patriarchal cultures where the feminine were vilified. And you can see the whole evolution from there, where we became witches and the women's arts and mysticism became evil and so on. So, yeah.
Wow. That gives me total shivers. It's, yeah. Do you find this yourself? So is this really you searching and decoding, or how do you work with stories?
Yeah. So we work a lot in the body. Yeah. So for example, the Apollo myth would be then that you would actually, yeah, first, like, one key is just to look at it from this different perspective. It's like, who's telling the story? And then you filter through the translator of the stories, and it's probably many translators. And then you can see, even, like, for example, in Apollo myth, you can see the story from the snake's perspective, or even from the priestess's perspective or Gaia's perspective, or sometimes even from the oak tree that was next to the well of Delphi. Mm-hmm. What would it look like then? And then, for example, we practice to get familiar with that snake energy. How does that feel like in the body? What happens if I begin to move my spine and my hips? What happens if I drop my consciousness down into the pelvis and in my legs? You know, where I begin to access a consciousness that is not so verbal, not so intellectual. It can be frightening because we have been kind of taught that we shouldn't even go there. We should kind of keep our breath, you know, our stomach in and our breath shallow, because what will happen if we drop down there? Yeah, we become this kind of too much woman or hysterical woman, or a woman, maybe we get access to our desire that is like we want too much, or, you know, it's like a lot of kind of red flags that warns us to go there. But, you know, in my circles and in my life, that is really where we go. We really feel this kind of longing for wholeness. Yeah, we see this a lot in mythology, where the goddess, you know, for example, Inanna, she's one of the oldest goddess myths we know of. By the way, her myth was written down by a woman, which is very interesting. But we're talking about like 4,000-6,000 years ago in Sumer. And we see the goddess like really as a goddess who is so accomplished and so revered among the sky gods. So she knows the spaciousness. She knows the cosmic universal consciousness. She's this bright goddess. And then she drops down to earth, where she marries a human king, and she begins to kind of feel a lot of more complex emotions. And then she hears a call from the underworld, and she travels down to the underworld to meet her sister there. And there is an integration happen. Actually, in her, she has to kind of dissolve all the identities on the surface and in the heavens. She has to kind of give it away in order to know herself deeper than that. And then she comes up again, and she's still the queen of the heavens and queen of the earth. But now this queendom or this identity is not dependent on her pushing the darkness away or pushing the under what's happening below the belt away. Like there's a sense of wholeness. And of course, in that, you know, parts of why we've been taught not to go down into the serpent-like energy is that there is a tremendous power there. We become powerful, yeah. Very powerful. We see Aninana when she comes back. She doesn't take any bullshit anymore. She's not so naive anymore.
She's seen the underworld and yeah. Okay.
She's not afraid. Mm-hmm. And she wants the truth. She doesn't want to pretend. She doesn't want to half the truth. She wants the wholeness. And in the wholeness is that what happens when we integrate also the so-called darker feelings or the unwanted parts of ourselves. In the integration, in that weaving into wholeness, we are weaving ourselves into reality, into the world, into how all things moves. Yeah, it's just the life and death goes together. There is no life without death. It's a cycle that goes like this. And part, root of the human suffering is that we think that we can put ourselves above that cycle. And it's just a very neurotic idea because it's just impossible. But somehow that's where we live and that's where we think that we can win the game. But we can't. Yeah.
And also many spiritual traditions, have this idea of conquering that and of like dissolving in love and light and putting all the blood and tears and sweat down. And
the thing is that we, all of us who have been doing shadow work, we know that there is no away. Just like when we throw garbage away, there is no away. And it's the same thing in our consciousness. There is no away. It just goes outside our consciousness. It goes into our shadow. And then it begins to have its own life. Yeah, like when in the beginning of our conversation, I shared with you my spiritual path in the beginning, where I had all of these realization and an identity as a spiritual person, but at the same time, I was helpless in the way I was acting because it was my shadow parts that just were doing, where it's like teenagers without parental supervision. They're just kind of doing their thing. And we see that in the world today. We see collectively our shadows are running so much of our society. Like we are not willing to own and include our anger, for example, in who we are. And then we see anger, just running amok in war and hatred and all of these things that are happening. In sexuality, we're not willing to include our full sexual self in our identity and in our definition of divine. So sexuality becomes in the shadow, and we see this whole internet pornography business. This is one of the biggest business in the world. And it is our shadow that is now living its own life. And now when you look closer at it, it is our shadow that is training our kids about what sexuality is. Because we are not willing to, to bring it up
bring it up ourselves. Yeah. But and coming back to this moment that you described before with 9/11 and with the start of your different spiritual journeys. So where you stand today and the practices you do today, how has this changed?
Well, it's constantly evolving. And for me, these kind of spiritual, we come sometimes to these crossroads. Yeah, like that moment was a crossroad for me that kind of just kicked me out of the trajectory I was in into kind of in that river of my evolution. I kind of came into an alignment. And it was a sense of, even if I'm failing doing this, just to be in that alignment is successful. Like it's a sense of success to be close to what I'm here to be and live, like close to me. And then, but that river is evolution. Yes, it will constantly change. And then you go into kind of habits again, or you go into kind of different kinds of denial. And then I've had some other wake-up calls like that in my life, where it's all of a sudden things become stripped down again and I become very honest with what really matters. And I become very clear about, the leadership of my own life, because in those moments we could just kind of wake up from this trance of thinking that other people have the right to define what's valuable. as if there is some kind of outer authority. I'm an adult. I can actually decide that myself. And that is a kind of constant waking up. Like, I'm constantly waking up from that because it's so ingrained to think that what I value, like what they are valuing, is more important because it looks more, I don't know. Yeah, it's like it's more applause over there. So it's a, for me, it's a constant stripping down and coming into honesty with what it is that really matters in my heart, and to really see that that is given to me from the universe and it's up to me to guard it or not. It's like nobody can do it for me. Nobody can take it from me. But to really guard it like a torch within me, like this is what I'm, what really matters to me. And then just the last years, I've been through an intense kind of underworld journey. I had very, very deep losses in my life. So I was thrown into the underworld in a way that I'd never experienced before in the same way. And it feels like these last decades has been a preparation for that. And with some of the keys that I have been cultivating in my practice that I see now is essential when we meet these places in our path. And that is to cultivate kindness and compassion with yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, my teacher used to say, be gentle, be kind to yourself. And I was like, yeah, you know, it's a little bit like thinking that that was a feeling I sometimes have and sometimes not. But now I see it as an essential tool we need to cultivate, because when we really have enough space within ourselves, there are exiled parts of ourselves that will come to the surface, ready to be integrated and embraced. And some of these parts are not pretty parts. They are not parts that we would identify with, or there's a parts that we are afraid of meeting. And to have cultivated the capacity to be compassionate and listen and hold feelings without having to, you know, fix them or judge them is such an essential part of the healing journey. So I'm seeing the kind of the main, like the simplest map within me that is integrated and awake within me is what I call the three mothers. So the first mother is awareness. To cultivate awareness is that room, yeah, that allows us to see thoughts and feelings not as an identity, but as thoughts and feelings. It's an awareness that allows that, yeah? So in Buddhism, that awareness is called Prajnaparamita. It's like a vast, spacious formlessness that kind of comes in. We access her in meditation, yeah? There's that kind of peace, spaciousness. And then when that spaciousness comes in through the body and through the heart, it can become that compassion, that nurturing, compassionate mother energy that can come, that is like a way we can hold our experiences, hold ourselves. And we have to hold ourselves first, because it's easy that we just project that energy over to others. But then our exiled little parts will be down here saying, yeah, but what about me? What about me? Yeah. So we have to bring that to ourselves too. And then the third mother, so in the Buddhist map, she can be White Tara, is that unconditional divine mother quality, or Mother Mary, is that kind of compassion. Like, yeah, you can cry as much as you want. I will never leave you. I love you. Like, it's that kind of very warm mother energy.
Yeah.
And then it's the third mother, which is the Green Tara, or Durga, or now Freya that I'm working with now. It's this boundaries. To establish protection and boundaries is essential for our whole being to thrive. And it's one that, you know, many of us are struggling with. We are confused about boundaries. And sometimes when spiritual dogmas come on top of it, we become even more confused about boundaries. So that is something that is very alive in my practice and work these days, is too.
The beautiful point of these three mothers is to have these boundaries coming really from this place of complete compassion and love, so that it's not boundaries against something, but for all of those parts with all the heart in it. So then I think it's a different sort of boundaries, no? Even though they can be really strict and really clear.
It's again comes down to become very honest with that very kind of intimate place within you, where you are very honest with what really matters to you. What it is that really, what your awareness and love is constantly turning towards in your life, yeah? And to be really honest about it, that, oh, it comes again and again and again. This really is important to me. This is what I desire. And we come into, like I did that 9/11. It came just like, oh, I'm actually not interested in this kind of climbing another spiritual peak mountain. I really, really want to find a way to embody this. It became very, very clear to me that this is what I long for the most in this lifetime. And once we become honest with that, like now I would say that my desire is a certain kind of, yeah, it's that communion with Goddess. It's really what matters the most to me. Once I become honest about that, it becomes like a spotlight that shows me my different actions and responses to my surroundings, if they are out of alignment or not. And sometimes, you know, when they're not, I have to hold myself in compassion and see that, okay, here we go again. We said yes, but, you know, it wasn't maybe a clean yes. Yeah, maybe it was, maybe a no would be actually more loving in this moment. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense when I'm becoming honest with what I really long for, you know, if I don't set boundaries around it, it's just also very visible to me that I'm harming myself, yeah, that I'm compromising what is most important in my life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like I said, sometimes I do that and I have to forgive myself and hold myself in that too. But I can't lie to myself about it in the same way anymore. So what boundaries are needed in order to stay relaxed and soft and connected? That's the mantra. And that's going to be different for each one of us, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but it sounds like a really deep practice.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If we had a book and you could share one story for the world to hear right now, what is the story you would tell?
Well, maybe I will tell the story that became the Three Mother practice. It is from the Buddhist tradition where the Buddha of compassion, they say that actually the Dalai Lama is an incarnation of this Buddha. And the Buddha of compassion, he had been, you know, serving the world for hundreds of thousands of years and so devoted to eliminate suffering in the world. And it is said that he was one day looking at the world and he looked at how the humans were acting. So much suffering, so much conflict, so much hatred. And it is said that his heart just broke and he just broke into tears and sobbing. And he was just like, oh, I give up. Like, there's nothing I can do. Look at this. I've been trying so hard for so long and the people are still suffering. And he cried and he cried. And it is said that one of his tears took form as a goddess. And this goddess was the White Tara, goddess of compassion. And his other tears took form as the Green Tara, goddess of courage, of boundaries, mm-hmm. of protection. And when we look at this story, behind the Buddha of compassion is Prajnaparamita. She's called the mother of all the Buddhas. So in this story, we can place ourselves as the Buddha in the middle, where we can so easily be overwhelmed and naturally heartbroken when we look at how the world is unfolding and how our actions are harming Mother Earth and mm-hmm. each other. And so many of us just feel so overwhelmed that we become numb or depressed or immobile. You know, we don't even know where to start because it just feels too big. But here we see a map. And first of all, we see that it's in his willing to let his heart break that something happens. So to feel our feelings keeps us alive and connect to our hearts. So it is an essential practice for us. And then we see how this, instead of us kind of just collapse into too much, it shows us a way that this heartbreak can become enlightened action. And there we see that these two mothers comes forth together. The compassion and the boundaries goes together, which gives us keys of how we can not only realize the vastness and awareness of Prajnaparamita and our own consciousness, not only feel the heartbreak and pain of the world, but how we can live it and embody it and hold it by cultivating and, you know, recognizing the different shaktis, the different qualities within us of clear, fierce boundaries in action and the compassion, because they arise from the same root, like you said, and it comes from a connection, yeah? Because many of us also goes into action without checking that these actions and boundaries and all of this is rooted in a wisdom that is mm-hmm. deeper than the different appearances that we meet.
Thank you. And if you, as a last question, if you, or what is the story you would like us to tell from this time in history, in hindsight, like in the future, what would you wish for?
I think it's an important question. I think it's very beautiful that you open that question, because it points to something that I think it's against something many of us are unaware of, and something that we need to remind ourselves of all the time, is that we have to exercise and also guard the quality of imagination. We have to be willing to imagine a better future. And that is, it's almost like when you go to the gym, you know, it's like, you have to build new muscles, because it's so easy to look at what is. And this is, you know, it's an aspect of our brain. It's called RAS, where we filter out, you know, we are having inputs all the time. And the way the brain makes it kind of usable for us is that it looks for what it can recognize, because it takes less energy for it. Like if it's new things, it has to create new neurological pathways. So in order to use as little energy as possible, it kind of looks for what's familiar. And then it filters out everything else. Like you maybe have seen that. Like I remember I bought a car some years ago. And after I bought this particular car, all of a sudden I saw this car everywhere. Yeah, because it's something like, and before I hadn't even thought about this car. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. It's just the way that the brain filters. So for example, in our relationships, like I remember there was a certain imprint of what I thought was love and what I looked for in a romantic partner. And it was actually a lot of pain, suffering, conflict, withholding, because that was like the imprint, it was familiar from my upbringing. So when I look for a partner, that I was looking for trouble, because that's what I associated with love. And mm-hmm. the effect was that was what I saw. I didn't even see the other guys. So it was I remember before I met my now ex-husband, we were married for 20 years in a different kind of marriage that was, you know, more evolutionary for me. And before I met him, there was a shift in my brain. Like I imagined a different kind of love. And then I could recognize it when I saw him. I know if I had met him before, it would be two ships just, you know, passing each other in the night. We would have not seen each other. So anyway, this is also what, of course, happened when we look at our world situation. Yeah, we begin to think that, this is just the way things are. Mm-hmm. I remember I met a woman, her name is Lynn Twist. She's the founder of the Pachamama Alliance, who works with the different tribes in the Amazon jungle. But at one point she was also the director of an organization called the Hunger Project, who works to eliminate hunger in Africa or in mm-hmm. the world. And she was so clear. I remember I was reading her book. It's a book I recommend. It's called Soul of Money. And because she was, you know, moving money from very wealthy people to people, like she called it investing in our future. We have to invest in our future, and it means that, yeah, you have to eliminate hunger. But just that she had this vision, very clear vision, she said, my vision is to eliminate hunger from the world. And mm-hmm. just her commitment, a vision of that, was again a mirror for me, where I saw that I somehow had accepted that that hunger, not that I like it or anything, but unconsciously, I thought that's the way it is. Yeah. Or like, oh, it's, but she was like, no, that's just something we have created. We can create something else. And then I was like, again, just expanding the mind and vision. Of course we can. Like, of course.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. But you have to see it. And that shows us how, you know, how easy it is if we go into this foggy perspective. So, so the other day I was thinking, I was just contemplating what happened in the pandemic with the lockdown. And I know that many people have different opinions about this, and I'm not going to go into that. But what I was contemplating, I was walking with my dogs just 2 days ago, and I was just saying, we did it then. We stopped everything. The whole world stopped and took a threat to humanity seriously. And if we could do it, I suddenly saw that, why couldn't we do that with the climate crisis? Why couldn't we really just get together and just stop the whole momentum of all of this? And so the story I would tell was like, wow, you know, the 2020s were where the humans really figure out that we could work together, and we just stopped the whole craziness, and we came together and we created these councils where there were people from all religions and all different races and all different genders. And we came together in councils where there was these councils in every little village and every city. There were councils where people just came together and had difficult conversations. And we all had this keys and access to a consciousness, an awareness that was bigger than our different opinions. So none of us would go into kind of feeling, you know, super threatened by another different opinions, because we had enough spaciousness within ourselves to know ourselves deeper than our different opinions and political views and religious ideology. And that was the key. That was the opening that allowed us to see that, oh, the diversity of our opinions will never, ever, ever go away. Like, the very nature of this earth is diversity. We will have so many differences. So our key and our what happened in our inner revolution in the 2020s was that we accessed an aspect of our consciousness that could hold diversity with love and respect, and we had access to the original instructions of how to live in harmony and reciprocity with all of life. And we had support to envision and create and imagine a better future. And we all learned to see ourselves in a bigger lifespan so that our actions really were more considerate also of the future generations coming after us.
Wow. I would go with that story. Thank you. If someone wants to work with you, practice with you, where can they find you? What can they do?
Yes, you can come. You can go to our website, Awakening Women. We have one.de, one German, awakeningwomen.de, and awakeningwomen.com. And we are also on Facebook and Instagram. And I come and visit Germany now and then. And we meet in Greece for a retreat every summer in Corfu. So all the information can be found at awakeningwomen.de.
Okay, I'll put it in the show notes also.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Charmelie, for taking the time.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you so much. This was really wonderful.
That was Charmelie Adak on Collecting Sparks. Thanks a lot for following us on this journey. I feel immensely honored for this chance to speak to Charmelie and have her share her wisdom with us. Her vision for the story we might tell about our time brought me to tears. And in the end, I had less of a feeling of having led an interview than being gifted an audience. I'm immensely grateful for everything Charmelie shared with us and hope you found as much inspiration in our conversation as I did. If you want to work with Charmelie, you can find all links in the show notes. If you like this episode, please recommend, share or comment. It would mean a lot. I will speak to you next time for the new episode of Collecting Sparks. See you then, Sarah.